Good afternoon. This is Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today is Corey Flintoff, former Moscow bureau chief for NPR. He was a radio journalist for nearly four decades. As a foreign correspondent, he covered Russian President Vladimir Putin's crackdown on dissent, seizure of Crimea, and war in eastern Ukraine. He was in Aspen for Resurgent Russia in the Time of Trump, a discussion about America's relationship with Russia, which he describes as being a new Cold War. So thank you so much for being here. I want to start just by reading you something that I found in The Onion. It's a fake article. It says,
you can't read it all, right?
Just a little headline. Upon injuring a toe Sunday, Corey Flintoff, newscaster for NPR's All Things Considered, unleashed a string of rich, pleasantly modulated obscenities. And I looked at your Twitter profile, and people really miss your NPR voice. So I guess I'm just asking, how's retirement? And just letting you know that people really, your voice is really something that was outstanding about you and your coverage.
It actually has been great. I mean, the transition between working as a correspondent and retiring has been great. But that's something that I do miss. You know, I do miss sort of being able to talk directly to people in the public radio world. That Onion article will last forever. Mm-hmm. And it happens that I have a friend, a reporter, who was sitting in on their editorial meeting when they made that decision. And I was really disappointed to know that somebody just pitched this idea and everybody said, yeah, sure. But with no discussion. It was, you know, it was embarrassing.
I think it's a compliment, of course.
Well,
so you retired in September 2016,
yes, right.
Is that correct? And the last story that I found that I think you did in Russia was covering their elections.
Yes, that would be right.
And then November 2016, we have elections. We elect President Trump in America. And I'm just wondering if you noticed similarities or differences and just what your reaction was as someone who had just retired.
Well, the election in Russia was a lot more low-key, and it was low-key by by planning, really, on the part of the Russian government. They did not want that election to draw a lot of voters, and they did not want it to draw a lot of attention. So, they were talking, you'd hardly know there was an election coming up in Russia. And at the same time, you know, we thought we were keeping up with the politics in the United States, you know, and it turns out that we were not, you know, speaking of myself and my wife, we didn't have any idea what was coming. And so by the time we got home and sort of gotten immersed, as everyone in the United States is, in the election process, we were shocked that, that things had become so polarized, among other things.
Did you feel that you could express opinions or use your voice in a way that you weren't able to as a reporter?
No. And that's NPR policy. NPR reporters are not allowed to contribute to political campaigns, not allowed to post yard signs, even in local elections and things like that. And I chafed at it when I was actually working for NPR. I have to admit, I think it's a very important policy. And very useful. You know, if you decide that you're going to present yourself as a truth teller, then you have to give up certain rights. You don't give up your right to vote, of course, but you do give up your right to promote candidates.
So can I ask why Russia? What was it like to get that call that you were going to be the bureau chief in Russia?
It was pretty thrilling, but it took such a long time. It took a long time for the bosses at NPR to make the decision. And at that point, I had just come back from India. If it had been up to me, I would have liked to have stayed in India. But Julie McCarthy, who was much senior to me and had just finished an absolutely dazzling performance in Pakistan, was offered a choice between Moscow and New Delhi. I was in New Delhi. I had been in New Delhi for the past couple of years. And she decided that she visited Moscow, and she decided that she just wasn't up for the Russian winters. So she chose New Delhi. Mm-hmm. And so the options for me and my wife became Moscow or Islamabad, We went to Islamabad a couple of times, and it was just not as interesting or as much fun. I hate to say this, but Pakistanis will tell you that too. Islamabad is not a very exciting city compared to Lahore, say, you know, or Karachi. And then I went to Moscow to sort of fill in during at the beginning of the Russian presidential election that brought Putin back to the presidency.
Wow.
And it was the middle of the winter, and it was pretty grim. But I come from Fairbanks, Alaska, originally, and so that wasn't a daunting thing about it. And plus, I had the sense even then that the next 4 years or so in Russia were going to be really, really interesting. And it turned out to be the case.
They really were. I mean, talk about some of the things that you saw and covered while you were there.
Well, when I first got there, they were still in the midst of these mass protests in the streets, especially of Moscow and St. Petersburg. Tens and in some cases hundreds of thousands, well, about 100,000 people turned out in Moscow. Ordinary sort of middle-class people turned out to protest the parliamentary election that had taken place just a few months before, and also to protest against Putin's decision to come back into the presidency. You know, it was a bit too open and shut for them. They felt it was an arrogant kind of usurpation of power and of the democratic system. And so they went out into the streets. And these are people who have a kind of collective memory of what can happen if you oppose the government in Russia. But they were amazingly unafraid. And so that was the very first of it. Then I saw the repressions that once Putin had been elected, I saw the repressions that he imposed on protesters or opposition people of any kind. The Russian media, which had elements of independence before that time, but you know, where he quickly either shut down or suppressed opposition news media, television and radio and newspapers, and just generally imposed a much more obviously autocratic form of government.
Hmm. What was your life as a reporter, as a foreign correspondent in that world underneath a government that was really cracking down on journalism, on protests, on speech?
Actually, it didn't affect the foreign correspondents terribly much in the first couple of years that I was there. I actually came to the job in 2012, and so for the first couple of years, there were not limits on foreign correspondents there, even though Russian correspondents were being harassed, in some cases beaten, in some cases killed or jailed. Foreign correspondents were pretty safe. The worst that could happen to you is that you'd be sent home. And that was a badge of honor to people who managed to do stories
right.
that irritated the government enough to get them thrown out.
It's like the kid who got kicked out of class in high school.
Exactly right, yeah. So our ability to move around wasn't limited in any way. And one thing about that job is that you do a lot of travel, both in Russia and in the former Soviet countries. I actually had 15 countries in my area. And of course it's impossible to cover them all properly, but I did cover Ukraine and the Baltic states quite a lot, Kazakhstan and so forth.
I imagine that even though you had a certain freedom as a foreign correspondent, you had to rely on sources who were Russian. And I'm wondering how you negotiated that.
Yes, it became increasingly difficult to deal with government people in the government ministries, for instance. You know, part of a job, if you're reporting on a political story, you have to get comment from the government. And it became very difficult. And what would happen is that people wouldn't say no, but they would stall you right up until deadline time. And then after you had called them 10 times, they'd say, well, it's just not possible. The scheduling just won't work out. So this went on for years, and it got progressively worse. And I think anyone who's been a correspondent in Russia over that time would say the same thing. And finally, one Russian official looked at me and told me the truth. This was shortly before I was about to leave. He said, he did this while he was refusing me an interview. He said, there's no percentage in my giving you an interview. You know, all I can do is lose. Either I'll say the wrong thing, or you'll take what I say and you'll somehow misinterpret it, or you know, present me in a bad light. There's no way I can win here, so why should I even talk to you? And that turned out to be the case.
Was your sense that people were afraid, or were they, did they see themselves as being on the side of the government working against you?
It's a little bit of both. And those positions evolved over the 4 years that I was there. When I first got there, it was quite easy to talk to people, to ordinary Russians. You know, it's quite easy to make appointments to talk to analysts and academics and people, you know, who could give you policy background and things like that. That got increasingly difficult over the time that I was there, until finally, shortly before I left, it became quite difficult. The only people who were really interested in giving us interviews were people who were directly in the opposition. You know, so very hard even to get somebody to give you a military analysis or something like that, economic analysis. And it became very, very difficult also to talk to ordinary people on the street. Now, that was in part because they didn't want to identify themselves, you know, in case there were repercussions. People were unwilling to give us their full names. And it was also because people, the government control of the media by that time was so complete that people really did believe that we were, you know, we were the enemy.
Russia has a powerful propaganda machine. What was it like to cover not just, well, an administration that people weren't necessarily just dodging interviews, an administration that was openly deceptive?
Yeah, that was difficult. And, you know, one of the best examples of that was that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which governs for foreign correspondence in Russia, insisted in my final year there that foreign correspondents all had to attend the weekly Ministry of Foreign Affairs briefing. That briefing was given by the spokeswoman, a woman named Maria Zakharova, and she'd spend the first 15 minutes excoriating the foreign press and picking out people, you know, for the New York Times, for instance, for some story that they absolutely disapproved of and insisted was fake news. They weren't using fake news quite as a label at that time, but they are now using it, you know, quite freely. But at that time, yes, the government was wanted to make sure that there were official pronouncements that said that what we were doing was lies, basically.
How is the term fake news used now in Russia?
In very much the same way that it's used by our own administration. People, if something, no matter how well researched something is or how well documented, if it doesn't coincide with the government line, then they just insist that it's untrue. You know, and it's simply a matter of saying that black is white. You know, the government has discovered that it can say, when it has complete control of the media, it can say pretty much anything it wants, and it does.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today is Corey Flintoff, who was in Aspen for resurgent Russia in the time of Trump. Flintoff was the Moscow bureau chief for NPR from 2012 to 2016. We're talking about the challenges of getting to the truth in an administration where the truth is a gray area. And I've heard discussions here about not taking everything President Trump says literally, that he doesn't mean what he says. And I'm wondering, from your experience, are there lessons that we can learn from Russia about what happens when the truth does become a gray area?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think there are things that we can learn from. You know, one thing that people often said about Russian news consumers is that people in general didn't necessarily believe everything that was in the papers or actually most Russians get their news from television, that they don't necessarily believe the news that they're getting, and they regard a great deal of it as a government line. On the other hand, you know, they sort of welcome it and they go along with it. because it fulfills other needs that a population has, such as patriotism. Russians are very patriotic people. It's something that goes back to their victory over the Germans in World War II. It's something that the Soviets took advantage of and promoted constantly through the decades of Soviet rule, that, you know, our patriotism is what overcame this enormous attack on us. And so that still remains a very important cultural idea for Russia. So if President Putin says that, you know, the country is under attack, sort of covert attack by the United States, people are inclined to believe it. If he says that we have to, you know, build up our military, you know, we have to make take a bigger and stronger position in the world, people believe it and they welcome it. So news actually fulfills a lot of other functions than simply giving people information or telling the truth.
What do you think the role of journalism is then in a world where news fulfills complex functions?
I think the role remains the same. I mean, I'd say that, for instance, during World War II, I imagine that American journalists would have said our duty is to tell the truth, to give people information, and to support this great country of ours. And I think that that's still true. I mean, some people would question or ask, well, what do you mean by supporting this great country of ours? And obviously, I mean that, you know, I see America as a source for good. I see Americans as people who have goodwill to the rest of the world and are willing to kind of put their money behind that idea, who are willing to actually sacrifice their lives and their treasure for what they believe is a form of good. So I think that, you know, as media, we need to think about, is this true? Is this information important to impart to people? And do we have a role to sort of inspire people and to bring out what we believe to be the basic goodness of the American people and the American idea? Does that make me a propagandist? Mm. Some people would argue that,
yes,
that third proviso of mine might do that, but I'm not embarrassed to say that.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about now, do you see as America as a wake to the reality of our relationship with Russia? And if we are not, how do we get there? How do we educate ourselves?
I think we are not awake. One of the sort of best examples of that is that in the year before I came home, if you watched the Russian television and read the Russian press, you would believe that the United States and Russia were on the verge of war. There was actually a kind of war hysteria going on in Russia at the time. I saw headlines that said things like, if Hillary is elected, she will surround Russia with a ring of nuclear weapons. You know, it was very close to hysteria. And yet at the same time, Americans were hardly giving a thought to Russia. And I mean, people who paid attention would notice about Crimea and the war in eastern Ukraine and that kind of thing. But I don't think that the average American was very interested in any of those things. And we as media didn't do enough to sort of to alert them to this. Now we're in a situation where a significant portion, at least, of GOP voters say that Russia is an ally, or Russia is a friendly power. My time in Russia taught me that Putin's Russia, Putin's regime, is not at all friendly to the United States. It's intensely anti-American, and is willing to take pretty amazing risks to do damage to the United States.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as business as usual, and what is unprecedented? You mentioned Republicans, for example, saying that Russia is an ally, which is counter to the position that they've held for decades.
Throughout much of the second half of the 20th century, the GOP was very hardline against Russia and said that you know, the United States needed to always maintain a great deal of military superiority over Russia. And the Democrats tended to be less involved in the whole thing and to see it as less of an issue for them. It's where they where it broke down was over military readiness and military spending, actually. So I think in some ways that has reversed now. And I'm not sure why it has, but I think the sort of admiration for the Putin regime, you know, Putin has cultivated himself throughout the world media as being the strong leader, sort of clear-eyed opponent of Islamic terrorism, you know, somebody who is willing to intervene in Syria, you know, a decisive leader. And I think that's something that made him more palatable to GOP voters, you know, somebody especially who presented himself as an enemy of Islamic terrorism and somebody who could be part of or partner with the United States.
Looking back, how do you feel about Russia and your years there? I mean, you covered the rise of Putin. You covered, I mean, the annexation of Crimea. But it was also your home for four, was it 4 years?
Yes.
So what do you, how do you feel about Russia now?
I really like Russia.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that anybody who's probably spent any amount of, you know, a goodly amount of time there and dealt with Russians on a regular basis would tell you the same thing. I mean, that Russia is a wonderful country. You know, it's a tremendously diverse, vibrant place. It has a wonderful culture. Russians themselves are really nice, really generous people. They're reserved when you first meet them, but it doesn't take long for that incredible warmth and generosity to come out, you know. So I miss my Russian friends. I write to them a lot. I miss the sort of beauty of Moscow. Moscow has some of the most wonderful public parks in the world. You know, it's a bit of a legacy of communism. You know, that these parks were created, you know, so that the workers could, you know, have a place to recreate themselves, you know. I miss the culture of a capital like Moscow. So it's the Putin regime that I really oppose. And I mean, if I have a mission at the moment, it's to let Americans know that the Putin regime is incredibly dangerous to us as a country. And I think efforts to, you know, to promote friendly relations with the Putin regime have to be very, very carefully handled. Mm. You know, we have a whole, it's too bad that the State Department has been hampered as much as it has by this administration, because we have a whole body of diplomats and analysts who've spent years and years examining the relationship between Russia and the United States and seeing how far we can go on the admittedly long list of very important things that we need to cooperate with them on. Things like nuclear nonproliferation, you know, tremendously important. You know, the wars in various parts of the world. There are a lot of things that we need to do with the Russians, but at this point, it can't be a handshake deal between two leaders. Mm-hmm. It has to be something that has to be very carefully thought out.
What do you think that looks like? How do we move forward now?
I think it's going to be really difficult to move forward for a long time. I think that Putin's throwing out of the American diplomats at the embassy in Moscow was kind of the final straw for him, a sign from Putin that he didn't see much point in continuing with the niceties, and that he might as well just let us have it. Admittedly, it was mostly Russians who lost their jobs as a result of that, including some friends of mine. But so that was a real shot across the bow for us, and a sign that he doesn't. He saw Trump, I think, as a potential partner before the election, and now he sees, what the administration has called the deep state, you know, the sort of permanent bureaucracy of the United States, the permanent institutions of the United States as something that will always be anti-Russian and particularly anti his regime.
What conditions would have to exist for Putin to lose power? Can you imagine those or no?
That would really, really be difficult, because a lot of the conditions that would seem to be dangerous to him have already happened. The Russian economy is in bad shape right now, not so much because of American and European sanctions as because of the drop in oil prices. It hit and is still hitting Russia extremely hard. And people, especially in the provinces of Russia, are finding themselves in very difficult circumstances, you know, living on very little. You'd think that would be a real killer for the Putin regime. But so far, you know, Russians are accustomed to great sacrifice. It's only in the last couple of decades that they've enjoyed economic freedom or improved living conditions. So when those improvements tend to fade away, they're not so surprised by it. You know? He has complete control over the media, so that even when things are failing, the media is constantly saying that he's doing a terrific job. More than 90% of the Russian people get their news from television, and the Russian regime controls 98% of the Russian media. Mm. There are lots of television channels in Russia, by the way, including state-run channels and also some nominally independent ones. But even the ones that are nominally independent are run by oligarchs who are sympathetic to Putin's regime. And, you know, they're putting out the same line that all the other state media are. So we have that. Mm-hmm. The Crimea situation and the sanctions, that's something that you would think would be harmful to Putin's regime, but he managed to make it a point of patriotic pride for Russians, managed to appeal to things that go very deeply back into their history. And so with the battle cry, Crimea is ours, you know, he managed to produce a situation where people really supported him enormously. So all those things that would normally do away with an ordinary politician don't obtain against Mr. Putin. I would have to say that I don't see, there's no other leadership in Russia that could take over. There's nobody in the wings, even as a successor to him. You know, there's real danger in this. You know, there are not strong institutions that could produce a new leader. So if Putin were to become ill and die, say, or his plane crashes, I think that Russia would be in a crisis that would take a long time to resolve and would be extremely dangerous both to the Russians and to the rest of the world.
Thanks to my guest, Corey Flintoff, former Moscow bureau chief for NPR. He was in Aspen for Resurgent Russia in the Time of Trump, a discussion about America's relationship with Russia. This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay. If you missed today's show, you can find it on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Cross Currents is a production of Aspen Public Radio.